started.
They bought two houses together.
There you go.
Brought his brother and his father. And,
if we get Dan Strom to sit down, the rest of us be in good shape, I think.
I don't think he's exactly.
So you haven't done anything yet either. You haven't had your license.
Yeah, it's cold.
Huh?
It's cold.
I'm sorry.
You know Bill Spangler did not about 80, I
think. Oh, it's a nice side.
Well, this session is
radiation business?
Supposed to be a discussion. I'm not going to give a presentation. I'm going 16. To hopefully lead a discussion. We'd like to remind you to stand up the little cards when you'd like to contribute, and we'd like to have all of you contribute. As we've been sitting listening here the last while, one of the things that occurred to me is that we have some people here who are interested in this data and who have to make decisions. And is any of the information that we have here useful for them in making their decisions? So I've asked Brian if he'd take just a second and tell us a little bit about some of the kinds of concerns they have, the kinds of decisions that they have to make. You know, we are setting standards for all kinds of things that I think the information on the internal emitters is going to be very critical for. I was talking to someone, and they said that now that if we have a dirty bomb and there's a activity level of strontium 90, for example, that will produce 2 rads dosed to the bone over a 1-year integrated time period, they're going to talk about evacuating a city. And when you talk about risk and hazard evaluation, you start to try to evacuate a city, then you know there's some serious risks and hazards involved. And everything we've heard about strontium 90 from Marv Goldman there today suggests that a couple of rads to the bone is not going to be a serious risk to the average person. And but people have to make these decisions, and there's a difference between a political decision and a scientific decision. I know that I worked for Roger for a number of years, and we talked science, and I went back to DOE headquarters, and I made a startling discovery. Science doesn't drive the system. Science doesn't have very much to do with it. It's the kind of needs that are there and the needs that are perceived. And so I wonder if you'd take a minute, Brian, and help us get started here.
Sure, thank you. First off, thanks for everyone for being here, and for PNL to put this on is an exceptional opportunity for everyone to participate in this dialogue. John Esker and I are from BARDA, the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, and we're responsible for a lot of the RADNUC medical countermeasure development, including decorporation agents. And our risk assessments come out of the Homeland Security, basically threat assessments that they do on everything. We have the 10KT model for a nuclear event, and we have dirty bomb assessments. We have source exposures. You know, someone leaves an iridium-192 source under the bench in a metro stop or something like that. And so we have all sorts of different scenarios that are mapped out for us. The decorporation ones are primarily from the a dirty bomb scenario, which has a different number of casualties and expected people who would be undergoing exposure. But what you mentioned clearly, the strontium 90 going off in an event in a downtown area of New York would potentially cordon off that area economically, and so we have both an economic threat as well as a potential health threat. So this represents, from a catastrophic model, the economics and the human health hazards and conditions have to be sort of molded together, and that's the politics. The science would say treat everybody. The science would say shut the city down. The politics says run everything the way you run it, and everybody is safe and nobody got hurt. So these sorts of things have to be weighed in the back room somewhere that I'm not privy to, and certainly our mission is to develop these countermeasures. To that end, we are looking at certainly mass casualties in a nuclear event and the combatant fallout and exposure to individuals there. How would we treat them, and what is the risk assessment to those individuals who are exposed is part of our model system. From an HHS point of view, the individuals who are getting those body burdens of radionuclides, the immediate threat is not truthfully apparent. I think that the hematopoietic event of a direct source exposure in a nuclear event is where we're acting on hematopoietic countermeasures, GI countermeasures, tissue-specific type of injury assessments. We're working with a lot of different individuals who are working on oral administration of DTPA, because in the casualty world, we aren't going to be able to do intravenous administrations. We can do this in radiation workers, 2 to 3 to 10, in a hospital setting. But when you start talking about hundreds to thousands of people who, and the worried well, that have to be in some ways controlled and tempered in their assessment of what they got exposed to, we have to have measurement techniques that tell us whether or not this individual has an exposure. We have to assess whether that exposure is a health risk and whether or not to treat. So the triaging is a critical element of our work. But the other piece of that is compliance and getting an individual to take medications that are going to be available, and intravenous administrations, which have to be managed by some hospital staff or whatever, are just not going to be part of the equation. So we have to develop medical countermeasures that are going to be easier to adopt and to will have the same effectiveness or better than we currently have. And I know Scott's working on some of those, and others are working on oral DTPAs and oral for all sorts of different agents. And indeed, the list we had in a handout here represents a lot of those threat agents. And we don't have countermeasures for many of them at all. So when we talk about cobalt, what are we going to do to pull cobalt-60 out of people? What are we going to do to pull strontium out? These are not exactly the only thing DTPA is right now licensed for is plutonium, curium, and americium. And as such, we don't have, in a legal sense, the capability of using these except under medical practice. And would they be used in a medical practice just as a next resort? So our goal here is to understand what the threat is, what's the information that can build our confidence in medical countermeasure development, what kind of agents are we need to develop, what kind of threat is the plutonium, americium, curium, et cetera, that might be developed in a terrorist or even an accident, a major accident. And how do we help you in determining whether or not countermeasures are going to be available, and how do we develop those? So it's a very complex problem, but I think that this is a huge step in understanding what these are all about.
Thank you very much. I think that because of that, you have to make decisions as to when to make these changes and the steps. While we're on this side of the room, I didn't know whether either of you would like to add to that.
My name is John Esker. I've been with BARDA for a fairly short period of time, but I was primarily in a lot of drug development. And one of the things I have learned quite a bit about is in terms of the process of how a lot of these decisions get made. And it sounds like one of the topics people are interested in is types of federal funding. Brian was indicating, we're in the business of medical countermeasures, not necessarily model development, but trying to take some of that basic research and transform it into applied research by which we can actually get a product out on the market or put something in the national stockpile. We do have quite a few funding opportunities, and they're all through the federal business opportunities up on the USGov website, FedBizOps. And as any of your programs may be related to some of those areas of interest, by all means, you know, we'd love to hear from you.
I'd like to just add one thing about what BARDA is relative to a NIAID type of operation or DITRA or even some of the defense opportunities, and that is that BARDA principally operates under the operations of contracts. We don't operate under grants. So we don't provide monies and then with an idea. We actually have the concept of contracts because what we are doing is taking stepwise development through the very costly portions of what we call the Valley of Death for drug development to FDA approval. And in doing so, we don't want to be sidetracked with new ideas and new operations. We thus take a product that has a good proof of concept for working, and that we take that product specifically and all the way through to the licensing event. And so our work is a lot of oversight to the program. It takes a product and develops its toxicology and its efficacy studies all the way through what's called the animal rule, because we can't provide lots of statistical data in humans. We have to go off and do them in the animal world and then do the correlates to the human experience. So we're a little different in that sense, that going through BARDA as a financial approach is through a contract mechanism as opposed to something that NIAID might do.
Go ahead. Brian and John talked about BARDA, and I am not a representative of NIAID. as I introduced myself, I'm the University of Maryland School of Medicine. So we are the recipient of a large NIAID contract. But NIAID is, in fact, in the business of doing more basic research. And ostensibly, they are funding more basic research to a point where it would be, you would identify a product in terms of countermeasures that could then be handed off to BARDA for full development. And so the NIAID does give out contracts, but they also give out lots of grants as well. And they have the so-called CMCR program, which is a sort of centers of excellence in which the basic research is supposed to be done. Now, a lot of the funding that is given out by government at in the present time, it's really transitioned to basic research, which they're still doing. But there's a large emphasis on product development. And that's sort of where the society is. That's where Congress is right now in terms of granting money. We happen to be in a position in our consortium that is the Medical Countermeasures Against Radiologic Threats, in which this is a contract, and we have the capability of taking an idea from discovery all the way through FDA licensure, through the animal rule. So to do that, we have a number of subcontractors. Ray, actually, and Loveless is one of our subcontractors because we have the mission, if you will. Our statement of work is very broad, and it covers everything from mechanisms of action for these drugs and including radiation, and then to address all of the radiation syndromes. So starting with hematopoietic, GI, we're looking at lung-induced injury. There was some suggestion to look at CNS injury. I don't think that's going to occur for quite some time. But there is a real program in each of these, hematopoietic syndrome, the GI syndrome. And right now, Tom McVitie and our group have really looked at a prolonged GI syndrome. And even the threshold is somewhere around 9 to 10 gray. So at about 10 gray, you will start seeing then and this is external radiation. So mainly from a LINAC, but cobalt-60 as well as cesium-137. At above about 11.5 or so gray, it we can get animals to live out to at least 180 days, but the GI tract still remains the same. There is if you look at histologically, it is very disordered, and it is not recovered for sure. So we see that as more basic research that has come out of this. Now, we've questioned, actually gone back to NIAID, our project manager, and said, you know, this would be an extraordinarily important project to be able to fund. We even had Tony Brooks come out, it was about 3 years ago, and discuss with him the possibility of trying to organize data in a way that would not be lost. And I've got to make a comment at this point, since I have the microphone, that it's extraordinary, the amount of knowledge that is assembled in this room. And it's not just the data. As people talk and they're talking about their experiences, how do you replace that? And unfortunately, I don't see a cadre of young people coming up. Now, it's refreshing to see the people that are sort of on these back tables that are younger, that are interested, but we have no national training programs or very few right now in terms of radiobiology. Perhaps if we go to more nuclear power like France, then there would be a renewed interest in those sorts of things.
A need.
Say again?
A need.
A need, a need, absolutely.
Stronger and positive.
Yes, it is.
A need.
And exactly. And there is not a perceived need at this time, which is one of the problems. But I think as we go on in the conference here, that hopefully we'll be able to discuss perhaps ways to get federal funding. I don't know if there are lots of acronyms, and I heard Brian say DITRA. Does everyone know what that means?
Defense Threat Reduction.
That is the Defense Threat Reduction
Agency.
The Defense Threat Reduction Agency, DITRA. And that's part of DOD.
Early stage development, much like NIAID, early research development, defense approaches.
Although they do have, they have funded some things in which they would take it from essentially discovery through licensure as well. They have those programs. But it's mainly for the warfare fighter. It's very, you know, it's much more directed. Their mission is more limited in scope. So again, I think that we somehow have to define agencies that either singly or together would be able to develop an interest in this, because it's such a valuable resource which we will not replicate.
Let me make one more point. There is an overarching organization in government called the FEMSI, which is the Public Health Emergency Medical Countermeasure Enterprise. And this is actually composed of the DOD, Health and Human Services, Homeland Security, the VA, Department of Energy, many different people, all meeting about once a month, I believe, who actually go over the portfolios and go over the needs of the nation, and ideas are presented to them, too, through various avenues. But mainly through our solicitations that we get inquiries and et cetera. So BARDA also has something called TechWatch, which is on our website for requesting meetings to talk about your issues, your requests, et cetera. And this is on www.medicalcountermeasures.gov. That website has a lot of information about what is available in FedBizOps, gives you some headway on what the mission of Health and Human Services is. There's similar ones for Department of Defense as well, but this one allows you to see some of the government's overarching missions.
I'm sorry, we just lost it. We got the mic now. We're not giving it up.
Yeah. Everybody gets a chance.
The data mining is obviously very, very crucial and very important, and there's lots of data analysis that needs to be done. in terms of future thinking, and it's just the tissue itself, whether it's wet tissue or paraffin blocks or slides, but particularly wet tissues, if there were those that were still available, and that molecular biology techniques could be applied to. This is where I think it's possible to make an argument that these tissues can be used to investigate mechanisms of action. Now, one of the requirements of the FDA in having a countermeasure, and again, that's where a lot of the focus is on, development of countermeasures right now. One of the things that's absolutely necessary is to have your mechanism of action defined, to go through the so-called animal rule. So in which you're using the normal phase 3 clinical trials that are required to be performed to get a licensed product through the FDA, there's really a substitution in which those pivotal trials are done in animals. And that has to be normally at least 2 species. And there it has to be some connection then that you're able to make with man, both in terms of safety and in terms of effect, the efficacy of the product. To do that, again, mechanism of action. And so I wonder if that could not be used as an argument where agencies that are really funding countermeasures could be using these sorts of data in order to further the enterprise of identifying and then developing countermeasures.
That was really very helpful, I think. And I think that as we continue this little discussion of the questions and mechanisms, I'm going to come to you, Tom.
Can we address
an
issue that just came up?
Pardon?
I can address an issue that just came up. I'm going to die in my seat if you don't.
Okay, go ahead.
No, I just need to comment that, you know, molecular biology studies have been done on paraffin-embedded tissues for a very long time. I mean, we've done it with exactly these archives for, you know, 10, 15 years. I mean, PCR-based methods for being able to do sequencing, for being able to do, you know, analyses. We have a grant funded now to do, look at mitochondrial differences. So I don't think we need to have the wet tissues to do molecular analyses. And immunohistochemistry is great on paraffin-embedded tissues. Not to say that the wet tissues aren't there and aren't useful, but I don't think we need them, and I just need to make sure that was clear.
Yeah, I think not having the wet tissues, I think you're a little more limited. But you're not blocked out of the ballgame by any means. There are lots of things that one can still do with the
gene chip arrays. We've done gene chip arrays with paraffin-embedded tissues. Now there are methods for working with samples that are in very poor shape. There are companies that sell chips that are deliberately meant for paraffin-embedded tissues that were originally designed to be used in hospital situations that now we've been able to use it successfully with our tissues. There are microRNA techniques that have been useful. I mean, so the array of technologies that you can't do on paraffin is very, very small. I mean, you maybe can't sequence huge segments, but what you can't do in huge segments, you can do in bits.
Yeah, well, I think that's really critical. And go ahead, Tom. I'm not going to forget you.
I keep hearing future here. We're working on it. We're going to do. We need realizing the social, political, economic, and psychological problems in this. Is there a plan today? All I need is a yes or no.
Yes.
Something happens. Are we ready? Even though it's not FDA approved, it hasn't been tried. We need. They're not going to wait until you get ready for them. They're going to do it the sooner the better.
Stockpile
sort of thing.
Has certain.
I've never heard anybody discuss that we're ready for it today. I'm
well,
sure
I,
you're not going to
I
tell us what
you
it
we're
is.
Not fully prepared.
I not
mean,
fully.
Just,
that's
you could never.
I don't think we're ever fully prepared
for
anything. Second question, we're talking about needs and all those sorts of things and the gold mine here and the advantage. I've been out of the loop for 15 years. I was in it for 32 years with dog manure that deep and thousands of dogs around. It'd be nice to know your ranked order of priorities of needs somewhere down where you don't blow everything out into the open and expose your hand or that. But where would you really like to be if you could be related to things like that? A short one-page or two-page list of things like Gail, myself, people have been out of it as well as in it. We could get together and say, gee, he said something that opens up a door. Some neutron dogs. How about high LETs? How's this relevant?
I suppose I could break it up into, I mean, medicalcountermeasures.gov will help you in discerning this, but the national priorities are in terms of we expect to be able to address an event within 24 hours. So medications that are required prior to 24 hours.
We don't
hours,
need to discuss them
all
now,
that
but
stuff, but
just
yes, there
a
are
brief
priorities.
Outline of those kinds of things so that, you know, it turns,
the
critical
Office
words
of medical
turn on synapses that get you going in this sort of stuff. Thanks, sorry.
You know, if you look across the threats, and it's all threat-driven, and that's where the money comes from, is if there's a threat. So the Cold War ended, everybody knows what happened. The bio threats have the largest pocketbook, I mean, by far. I mean, it's probably, they probably have 80% of the funding, is that about right? Then there's chem, and then there's nuclear.
Okay.
And so we're probably the last on the totem pole, although, you know, it's still significant funding, but it's certainly not what the bio community is getting. Now, there was the National Bio Threat Science Board, the NBSB, and this is a vice presidential nominated committee. And Tom McVitie actually is a member, and he's really the only rad nuke person that's on the board. They recently published a report in which they had they critiqued the program that was going on within the United States, they view it as really woefully inadequate at this point. In terms of time, and what they see, they see what we really need is another Manhattan Project to bring this to the fore and make it in such a time frame that it's going to be useful. Because as you say, you don't know what's going to happen. It could be tomorrow. And so there is an urgency, and there needs to be more of a sense of urgency to make these things happen. Now, you know, BARDA is they're a new organization. They have limited funding. You know, if you look at what it takes to bring a drug to market, and everybody's heard the figures of anywhere from half a billion to $1 billion.
I live in the backyard of Eli Lilly, and trust me, I get this feedback all the time.
And
it's another decade.
We were at Merck, this is 5 years ago, and at that time, Merck said it takes about $800 million to bring a new vaccine to market. And so if you look at the amount of funding that is being given to BARDA, DOD, NIAID, it's inadequate to really, and then you're going across a very broad front, trying to address numerous threat agents at the same time.
One more comment. You can't wait till FDA approves it. If it even smells good, put it on a list and define when you use it. Because sometimes using something that isn't clearly defined is better than doing nothing.
Well, and that's exactly right. And there are other mechanisms.
That's where we gotta be.
There are other mechanisms that the FDA has. One of them is called emergency use authorization. And that, in which the secretary of HHS can actually say yes, you can use it in this emergency, and you can pre-deploy the data, and it's sort of where the state is of the state of development is, whether, and then the benefit risk ratio that they would have to make a decision on, but that's essentially what happens, and then right now those are really the only two real mechanisms. There are a couple other things in terms of emergency use IND, in which you have to get essentially a signature from everyone in order to use it. But there are other mechanisms besides actual licensure. That's what they would prefer.
You need to get MacGyver on the committee.
There you go.
With a Swiss Army knife, he solved everything. Remember that?
I think what we want to do now in the next little while is to talk a little bit about what we're doing here, and is there a way that we could organize ourselves better as a consortium or a group of people with common interests to be able to address the problems that you have and be able to come forward with the kinds of proposals that would be appealing. And I don't know if we want to spend a few minutes talking about that. And then the final area that I want to talk about was that I know that a lot of you people lost your funding before you figured you should have. Yeah. And are there a few projects left out there that if you would have just had another year or another little pile of funding, you would have got done? And if we could get a little input on that from you to help direct these young people. You know, when I come to a meeting and I'm one of the young ones, I know I'm in trouble. And so you look across the back rows there, and that's where the future lies. And so if we can, as a group here, talk a little bit about consortium. Now, Marv, do you have something you want to...
Is picking up on what you were saying. I'm not in the loop with the acronym club any longer, but I am in. Is it on?
I can't hear you. Of course, I'm hard of hearing. So.
Is this working?
Yes.
Yeah, that's good.
I don't know if it's that important what I'm going to say, but in any event, regarding the threat story, it seems to me that the lessons from the Beagle studies might be helpful in helping to develop something that I'll call a chemical armamentarium for a dose reduction. Once the dose is delivered, though, there's damn little that's going to happen that's going to reduce that threat. And in many cases, the chemicals that we've invented are more dangerous and deleterious than the consequences of not using them. The second thing is for external radiation. You know, you're dealing with a stochastic situation, and the basic research that we're talking about is bumbling around into the fundamentals of what causes cancer. And I don't know whether this kind of a program is really going to be at the forefront of it. In terms of looking at the tissue analyses, you're going to see molecular changes that were the result of stochastic and deterministic effects, but not necessarily an ability to sort out which were direct and which were indirect. And therefore, I think in terms of threat reduction, I believe one of the most profitable things would be instantaneous dose assessment. And the things that we do in radiation for dose assessment are not necessarily always the fastest. So those things that could accelerate and get you something within less than an order of magnitude uncertainty in quick time probably have a lot of value. And some of the things like the TLDs and the like are helpful in this regard. And once an internal emitter has become internal, your options are limited. And as these studies have shown, in many cases, the risk is far smaller than the political prediction would predict. And therefore, I'm wondering whether there's such a thing in your framework as what you might call a practical threshold, not for effect, but that below this, what we used to call it, below regulatory concern, that some of these doses, if instantaneously known and reasonably verifiable, would remove a large segment of the population that would be clamoring for us to do something from the need to do it. Now, I'm probably speaking practically, and that's not acceptable
right on target. We
some
have
places, I've given it a lot of thought, but there are some things you can do.
Right.
And some things that really are really the result of quantifying what's going on. And just like in Chernobyl and everywhere else, once the accident occurs, the most crying need is for an instantaneous or rapid understanding of what the exposure is.
Exactly.
And I don't see that we've really done that well in that over the last 20 years over what we had done earlier.
There are, I think, existing right now about 12, maybe 13, and potentially up to 19 contracts in just dosimetry itself in terms of biomarker assessment post-exposure in an acute event. And this has more to do with the prediction of a large population of 500,000 people who would be the worried well as well as those that are exposed, and that we would have a positive signal within seconds, you know, swipe the cheek and get a purple stain on a stick or something that would tell you that you have a biomarker that indicates a threshold limit that would be basically a threat of hematopoietic injury, because that's our immediate concern for anyone in a radiologic event, that they're going to have a hematopoietic
injury. An external radiological event.
Certain rate,
yes.
Of course.
Yeah.
And again, this is our threat assessment, that the first issue, the main issue we will face is hematopoietic depression in those that are exposed to whatever the blast information was. Whether that's a radionuclide event or not, it is irrelevant. It's really the actual exposure and whether it is centered on the hematopoietic centers of the body, that's where we have to make the assessment. And the next one is gastrointestinal. And then we talk about lung and lung pneumonitis and lung fibrosis. CNS being a very high dose challenge, we probably won't be addressing that, not in the near future. What we are going to address are the 2 to 8 gray individuals who are at threat for even 1 gray, potentially, for some more sensitive populations for hematopoietic injury.
But 1 gray.
Yeah, I think this could go on quite a long time here, and I don't think we want to invest the last of this time on it. But we have to be very careful that we make sure we're talking about external acute versus internal chronic low dose, low rate. So this group here, I don't think, can provide you much help in the external acute field, but as far as internally deposited chronic, then I think we can do pretty well. Go ahead, Jeff. Diet's a big thing. You can change the response a large amount just by modifying diet in experimental animals. And so just because you have the initial event doesn't mean that you're destined to get it. And like you say, there's a lot of that kind of thing. You had another hand there? Anyway, I think Bill Morgan kind of charged me a little bit with trying to get a little bit of a discussion going in terms of how could we cooperate. I don't know, Bill, if you have any red-hot ideas on that to push this on, or should we?
I wish I'd had a red-hot idea on anything. It hasn't happened for a while. But I think one of the things that there's a lot of information in this dog data, and what I'd be really keen to know is what are the next set of experiments that address some of these issues? So, even talking to Tony James, who understands these internal emitters and looked at humans that have had exposure to decorporation agents, what was that based on? Why did they decorp for that long? Why did they stop? Should they have kept on going longer? And is there information in the dogs that could help us answer that type of thing?
Yeah, I think that Tony's got some very nice human information, and we've got some good dog information on distribution, dose, and outcome. How can we link those? What kinds of things could we do in the dog tissue that we could also do in the human tissue? What kinds of genetic markers, what kind of molecular markers? You might say, well, whatever we do, like Roger was saying, we got to drive it by a hypothesis of some kind. So what are the hypotheses that we would use to look at these cancers induced by in the dogs. Now, as I've looked at it, I kind of think, well, you know, inflammatory changes and chronic irritation and chronic disease, if you look at the beta-gamma dogs, low doses, when I say low, I mean below about 20 gray, you don't get very much in the way of increase in lung cancer. But if you get up to 200 or 300 gray, almost everybody gets lung cancer. And so is that just a result of turning on a chronic inflammatory disease of some kind? Could we measure that? Could we measure the disease as it progresses? Could we measure dogs with and without it, et cetera? Go ahead there, Scott.
One of the things that always strikes me in this area with the dog studies and the human studies is that we're jumping from this almost this organ-level dosimetry, particularly relative to plutonium alpha particles. And the question oftentimes come up when we're looking at a particular pathology, and we ask the question, when did that cell see an alpha particle? Yeah. Because there's a huge difference between talking about a gene change and then where that alpha particle is. So much of our dog studies is we're looking at where the alpha particles are now when the dog died, but not where they were when they caused the cancer. And so we have a lot to learn, particularly as we start looking at some of these defects in our current models, the ICRP models, because where they're not very robust, where they're not predicting, and we still lack a lot of knowledge about where the plutonium is, where it's moving, when it's moving, why it's going there, what cells are intersecting it, what cells are causing the effect. And we seem to jump from this tissue organ down to the molecular level, and oftentimes there's this huge disconnect.
I think that's one of the big challenges, because when I learned radiation biology, you about had to hit a cell in order to get anything out of it in the way of a biological effect. But then once we developed the microbeams where you could hit cells and know which cells you hit, and look at the neighbors and say, hey, they're responding. How come with that? So I went back and thought about some of the studies we did at Loveless where we took plutonium particles of different sizes, injected them, they went to the liver, and then we looked at liver cancer and chromosome damage as a function of particle size. The old hot particle hypothesis was that if fewer cells sitting close to a particle, you got huge doses, so you had a huge risk. That's why we did the studies. What it turned out, a lot of it, is the amount of chromosome damage, whether it was thorotrast or plutonium, was dependent on the total dose of the organ. And if you had a few big particles or a lot of little particles with the same total dose of the organ, aberration frequency and cancer frequency are both similar, which made me shake my head, because it shouldn't have been if we're only hitting a small fraction of the cells with the big particles. So you're making a response in the whole tissue. The cells are talking to each other, and they're communicating. And so because of that, the response and calculating dose to localized regions and dose to individual cells, I decided, well, maybe that's not what we should be doing. Maybe we've got to understand how the cells are communicating with each other and what are the events that are triggering. Now, I don't know what other hypothesis any of you'd like to talk about. What I'd like to do is open it now for just a few minutes and say, well, since you guys, a lot of you are about through with your careers, and there's some people out here just starting their careers, what was the study, Fletch, you'd like to have done that you didn't get done at Loveless? And that you'd say, well, if I had a young person that I could train in my image and turn him loose on this problem, it would be a good thing to spend his time on or her time on. You have one or two? Just be thinking about that. I'm trying to – go ahead, Jerry. You got one. Turn on the button there.
Oh, okay. Relay what you've been talking about and the question you proposed to Fletcher. What I haven't seen very much of is we talk about whole body dose, and we talk about organ dose, And I've seen that word on a slide. I've seen the word tissue dose, but it was inappropriately applied. They were talking about organ dose, and they said tissue dose. And so there's some confusion of tissue dose and organ dose. And I don't think we've seen much in tissue dose. If I had a graduate student, I'd like to have them look at audiographs in the different tissues of the lung. And the lung is the organ. There are different tissues in the. I would like to see the dose around the alpha tracts around bronchioles, in alveolar septa, and the subpleural. And those are all areas where the lymphatics drain. They drain into the pleura, and they drain up the bronchial tracheal chain. Mm-hmm. And I think the tumors of dogs, they come from probably come from bronchiolar cells. We could study that more, but that's a reasonable hypothesis at the moment. They come from bronchiolar cells, and to find the dose exposing to bronchiolar cells versus the dose that's buried in scar tissue someplace else. And so it's a tissue dose that really needs to be looked at. It's not enough. So that's what I would like to have a graduate student do, is look at the tissue dose. I would also like to get away from this paradigm of the word stochastic. You know, we don't really know what causes lung tumors. We have growth factors involved, and the radiation could interfere with growth factors. We have a loss of cell-to-cell contact. Sure, we have genetic changes that can cause cancer, but you know, there's just more of this cell to, this is, these are all been said. There's cell-to-cell contact we could look at. I think we should just have a little bit of doubt when we use that word stochastic. We know what we're communicating, but there may be other things. Those are a couple of things I'd like.
I appreciate that, Jerry. You know, I want to bounce one quick, because it's the study that Loveless that never got done that I thought would have been a wonderful thing. And I wonder if we could go back and do it now on these tissues. We called it a dial-a-dose. Remember that? Where we were going to dial the dose, and we were going to give the proper amount of, I think it was plutonium to the lung,
yeah.
Bruce.
Right.
And we were going to produce 50% tumor incidence in the animals.
And serial sacrifice.
And then before we did that study, we were going to do everything we could on the immune system, on DNA repair, all of these things, you know. And then we'd have a distribution of all those things, and then we'd go back and do the animals and see if we had any predictive value. Was anything we did ahead of time said anything about whether the animal got a tumor? Well, now that's all gone and passed, but could we go back now and apply some of the stuff like Gail's talking about? I don't know, other newer techniques, new molecular biology, cytokines, whatever, and do something to say, oh, I can measure these now in here. This one had high, low, medium, and it did or didn't get tumors.
So
but anyway.
There are now actually fluorescent chromosome probes for the dog chromosome, so you can go back and do the cytogenetics.
Thanks.
Nice, thanks.
All 78 of them, they start small and they get smaller. And, each band would be one chromosome probably. But anyway, there are lots of molecular techniques that you can look at genetic changes. You can look at translocations. You can look at a lot of other things. Even if you were to do something very simple-minded, like look around one of these plutonium particles in the lung. Now, you know the particle has about a range of 40 microns in the emulsion, but in the tissue it'll go 180 microns or so. Now, are there any markers in that region around that particle that would tell you something? Or is the whole lung activated? You know, what is this communication inside a real tissue, inside a real animal, exposed to real particles? Combining autoradiographs with cell molecular techniques seems like it might be kind of helpful if you could do that in humans and in animals. Right. And the other is
brand new experiments.
Either new experiments or tissues that are available. Now, it would be really neat if you could sell a new experiment.
I did want to mention one thing. I sent it to Bill, and then I forgot to bring it myself.
At the Hutch, they have a core facility that supplies molecular biology material, probes, sequences, all for the canine.
Right.
Actually, I was serious about the chromosome fish probes. Right. And outsiders can use it. You can go on the website, find it, and you'll see the list of materials. It's mainly for the Hutch community, but through collaborations, since it's a federal-funded thing, you can get access to that material.
Yeah, that would really be wonderful, because I remember when I first started trying to do a little molecular biology on the dog, had all kinds of human probes. We didn't have any dog probes, and so you couldn't really do much with the dog, but you could do all kinds of things. But now, like you say, the dog's caught up. People are gotten more interested in that. But I think what we have to do in all of these, like I say, is make sure we know the question we're asking, make sure we know a hypothesis we're testing, and then go in and test it. I'm going to come back to you, Fletch. You ready?
Well, one of the recently reported...
Go ahead.
One of the recently reported very interesting developments in the field of lung was a recent study done at Yale where they took a rat lung and they digested off all of the epithelial cells so that they had kind of the skeleton of the lung hanging there, and they took, there were no epithelial cells in there. This sounds like a magician's trick. They stuck in some stem cells and let them grow a while. They took that lung out. It was a rat lung, by the way. They transplanted that rat lung that had been repopulated into a rat, and that rat lived for, I think, about 6 or 8 hours. And it's amazing to me that how do those stem cells know where they're supposed to go? We always talk about cytokines and talking among cells, but it's epithelial cells that we're really talking about. And this was a cell, this was the matrix cartilage in the lung, and those stem cells got to where they were supposed to go. So that just comes back to the point about the role of the matrix in inducing lung tumors. And I was thinking about what's the role of in plutonium-induced tumors, and maybe even beta-induced tumors in dog lungs. What is the role of fibrosis in inducing in the lung tumor induction? And there's been some talk about that and studies and some things done on analysis done on our dog lungs and some work here at PNL that talked about the coalescence of particles around fibrous tissue, and that was a key thing in inducing pulmonary tumors. But is that just an effect of dose? And if you get down to a lower dose, do you really need to have fibrosis to occur? And I've thought about this, but I haven't really thought about it yet, processed it yet, as to how that might, how you might look at existing tissues to answer that question, or whether it would require some new type of study.
Very good. And I think that, like I say, anything from chronic inflammation to fibrotic changes, all those things I think are very critical in the changing the microenvironment in a way that the cells don't communicate with each other as well as they did. Remember when I first came to PNL, Fred Cross had a whole bunch of rats he'd exposed to radon. And he had a lot of tumors in the lung, but he didn't have any tracheal tumors. And there were hardly any tracheal tumors at all. And I says, well, Fred, how come there's no tracheal tumors? He says, well, maybe they don't get a dose. Pony James told me, he says, well, you give me the diameter and the airspeed and the flow and the branching angles and four or five other things, I'll calculate the dose for you. And I says, well, I'm a biologist, so I'll just look at the cells for micronuclei and I'll measure the dose. So I looked at nose and trachea and deep lung, dose is about the same. Now, what's the difference? The different kinds of tissue are responding differently. They get the same dose. The communication, the interaction between the cells is very different. And so there's something in that trachea that's preventing those cells from going on. Now, maybe it's turnover rate of the cells. Maybe it's a lot of other things. But I think we have to remember that the biology of the system is very, very important. I think we've listened to the physicists in almost too much and too long. No insult to anybody who does physics, but I think the biology really has to be considered in driving the system. Go ahead,
Tony. You asked what experiments study you'd like to do that
right
you hadn't done. Well, of course, I didn't do any, but I would like to see. I think most of the experiments that we've heard described today would benefit from new diagnostic means.
Yes.
Two things in particular: routine MRI imaging of animals where you can see tumors without sacrificing them. So instead of sacrificing dogs along the way, you watch the tumors grow, and then you see not only one tumor, but maybe two or three primaries show up. And right, so you actually get a lot more data for the same experimental animal.
Right.
And the other one, of course, is all the molecular endpoints that you might access through proteomics, where you compare the – you have to know the genome to do it, but you compare the proteomes over time in the dogs, also not requiring sacrifice. So I have no idea where all that leads, but those are certainly experiments that we would do today if we had the colonies we had 50 years ago.
Right, right. If the problem, I think, is convincing anybody to do another dog study. The only way I think you could sell one probably would be to convince them it wasn't a lifespan study, that it was a molecular biology study and it was a mechanistic study, and you indeed would follow it with time. One of the problems all of our data is we got a lot of data up front, then we got the tumors, but we got almost nothing in between. They just sit and incubate, and all of a sudden it pops up. And so if you have some non-invasive ways that you could follow the progression or the changes, that would be really, really, really exciting. And I think you could maybe sell something like that. Well, it's not a lifespan study. We're going to do it for 5 years, but we've got all of these things we're going to do over this five-year period. And in some of the higher doses, of course, you can get tumors in that length of time. Go ahead, Scott.
These days, you'd use micro-PET imaging or PET imaging, positron emission tomography, and then which they, of course, use in humans, and that's great for detecting cancers. And there's all sorts of new probes emerging. And
right,
you can do that in rodent studies.
Yeah, I think that if we could do any of that on a new study, I think we all have lots of ideas we could do on a new study. But what about, is there something we could do here collectively to pull together a consortium that would involve a Tony James or a Gail and a Bill and a Scott Miller and put forward some kind of a worthwhile proposal that would say, hey, we're working together, we're going to work this stuff out, and you should help us by some funding. Go ahead.
Yeah, just a couple comments to make. The one way I think that the tissues can be useful in generating new experiments is if the old experiments do something in large numbers, which then you can do a small number of animals to test, or you start with a small number of animals and now you find an endpoint that you need to go back to the large number of animals. So I think that's, because I don't think it's likely that large number of animals will be done again, so I think that's one thing, is the kind of going back and forth is quite possible. But, you know, I'll say that one of the things that we've done that's hurt this community is we haven't made all the information that we have here be broadly available to the large community. So many people, most people don't even know that these experiments were done, much less that there are still data out there and that there are still archives out there and that there are still tissues to be used. So I think that we need to somehow advertise this, whether it be through the web, which Ben will talk about tomorrow. I don't know. But I also think that one thing that I, as a person working in this field, would really benefit from is if we could establish some sort of consortium here where we can actually develop real collaborations between the people who did these experiments and the people who are doing the experiments now. That would be extremely useful. I mean, I can't tell you how often I go to Tom to ask him questions about things. I mean, if that ability to be able to have a feedback back and forth between the people that designed the experiments, that did the experiments, and the people who are doing them now would be a big benefit. And there's not even a way right now easily to track who did what. Like, let's say I wanted to go back and do an old data analysis, and I wanted to include authors from the original studies on it as authors on the paper, and I wanted them to review it and look at it before it went into print to be sure that I was accurately reflecting how the experiments were done. I can't find it half the time. So we need to develop some sorts of means of being able to track who did what and establish communication to go back to actually address those questions, because I certainly think that these experiments were so complicated and so difficult to understand. I mean, many of you have worked on this for 30, 40 years of your lives. I mean, you know, a new investigator walking in can't possibly grasp all the details associated with it. I do think that this link between, you know, the people that did the experiments and the people that are working now is really critical.
I think, Ray, I'd like to call on you there. Since you're probably as close to anybody as doing experiments right now and come from a big background of, I'm sure that may be, not be what you got your card raised up for, but
not.
Go ahead, ad lib a little, and then you can go on and ask the real question.
Well, I just wanted to tell you a little story about some of the other biological materials that we haven't talked about because we've been focusing on the lifespan studies. I mean, Fletcher and I worked starting about 10 years ago in trying to determine what the distribution of plutonium is in human lungs, something we really can't do very easily with the lungs that we get from workers in the United States because our radiation protection program worked and, you know, we're not getting any effects. Well, in my act, they didn't exist, and people got exposed to an awful lot of plutonium. So we developed some techniques of doing some good statistical quantitative sampling of the lung. We did autoradiography and did a nice technology transfer to our colleagues at the Southern Urals Biophysics Institute so they could do this and continue doing it. And we did a bunch of lungs, and we determined where particles were when you die. At the same time, Fletcher, being a pathologist, and his good colleague Chris Nicola also took a look at what was going on at the pathological level and made a lot of, I think, insightful observations, but then tried to relate one to the other, you know, where the particles, how many particles, what might be the dose, and where the lesions and all this good stuff. Well, all of us recognize that what we're looking at is an end-of-life event. You know, and is there any correlation between where the particles are when I die to where the doses were actually delivered and lesions were being created? So we got together and we said, well, you guys have the technology now to do all the autoradiography, and you can do immunostaining of cells and all this good stuff. I'm going to send you my paraffin blocks for my dose pattern study, where I had known doses in dogs and serially sacrificed out to about two and a half years. And, you know, do the good work that you're doing on the humans and do it on the dogs and see what you can find. And they're doing it.
Yeah, yeah. Those are the kind of correlations that we need. I wonder if you would address back to what Gail was talking about, to the potential for making people available who did the work plus people available who are doing the work, or any kind of a formation of a interactive group?
Well, there are two approaches that I can think of. One of them is do it fast, because the clock is running for all of us.
Right.
But secondly, and probably more importantly, is that I think we need to make a concerted and organized effort to be bringing together all of the experimental information together one place so that it can be accessed by anybody and understood by people who didn't do the studies. I mean, I think that's one of the hazards of making you know, the dose response information available to people who had nothing to do with these experiments. But at the same time, we don't want to censor their use. So the solution is to get this information in some form that's accessible and correct, and then make that available to the people who want to use the data. I come from New Hampshire. Sometimes I say data. and the biological materials, because they all have to go together.
Right. Good thought. We've about run out of time. What I'm going to do is go bing, bing, bing. We'll give the three of you a go, and then Bill's going to wrap it up. So you go ahead and start.
I got a quickie. One of the things I've often thought about is, why don't we pretend that there was no such a thing as ICRP, and the only data we had in the world was the Beagle data? And then for each of the radionuclides, come up with your Beagle determination of what the risk is. And, you know, the models are a combination of... No, just seriously. If that's all you had, what would you come up with? I have this problem. I'm on a committee now reviewing the plutonium-238 risk for the launch next year of the Mars Science Laboratory, which will have 10 kilograms of plutonium-238. And it's not a threat, but it's a risk problem that should there be a Challenger-type accident and we sprinkle pixie dust over the eastern seaboard, what kind of a issue would we have? And, of course, we use all the modern ICRP models and everything, and everyone's cool and the like. I said, okay, we've also used a little bit of the Russian data to come up with an independent thing. I said, what about if we had the intelligence to step back from our biases and models and just take the 238 Beagle data? You've got variations in method of administration and like, and just come up with, what do you think the risk should be? Maybe an order of magnitude type of thing. We know how to extrapolate from the Beagle to man. We've often dabbled with it in the concluding paragraphs of our publications, right, right. But we've never really done it. Now, that's something that could be done with the data that we now have without any new studies. And I think it might provoke some interesting questions about what we might want to do. And by the way, I have this 238 report done in a month, so if anyone can help me, that'll be helpful.
Those are the kind of thoughts we really need. That was very, very nice. Go ahead, Tom.
Two comments. First one was your previous comment. Let's get the acute doses down. That's the priority. The day of the boom, we should know everybody's dose. Go to Google and Apple. They can give it to you. Anybody with a cell phone here that they're carrying? Huh?
Yeah.
London does it for every automobile entering Central London. They know who you are. The electronics is available to do that. Second comment is, I agree with what Fletcher and you just said. We have the dose and the animal and the exposure, and we have the results. Look at the effect. Maybe I can get you to copy it out of that same British Journal of Radiology. Tom Seed and I published a paper. It was his work, basically. Right. I gave him a lot of interesting dogs. He very discreetly defined the development of leukemia in a dog being irradiated. At 200 days of irradiation, which induced a high proportion of leukemias at 10 R a day, centigrade, call it whatever you want, and he could predict which ones are going to get leukemia and which ones aren't. Those specimens are available, blood films, bone marrow samples, and all that. You want to know what happens to a dog from 400 days of age till he dies of leukemia at 1,500 days or 2,000 days? It's all there. The whole thing. Where's the technology? Let's look at it.
Well, and not only that, but also that we have live samples that were frozen in liquid nitrogen that are available. I have an entire freezer collection of leukemias at before and after the pre-leukemias and everything.
Tom got to be very, very good at predicting.
That is really good stuff. He used standard medical techniques, sequential bone marrow aspirates, cloning them, looking at the sensitivity of stem cells at 500 days, 1,000 days, 300 days. 1,500 days. It's all there. There are differences. There's things you can do. But I think there's a lot more with Gail's techniques to tell us what is the story. And
what's changing.
Granted, it's not acute stuff, but it'll tell you at the end of the year who's going to get leukemia and who isn't, who should we do what with, do they need new stem cells, what's going on here. But get the acute doses down. We could map every person in this room today or wherever we go tonight. All it takes is money.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, well, I know that Gino Saccomano got really quite good at taking sputum cytology samples out of uranium miners and predicting lung cancer, too. Yeah. And if you could just follow those progressions. Now, go ahead, and we'll let you finish since you're one of the younger ones here, and it's good to have some comments from you. Go ahead.
I just wanted to build on the point that Ray and Gail were making, that we need to document the studies better and to centralize that documentation and just emphasize that a lot of that work has been done. Of course, there's a lot of work in these annual reports and that's been published in the literature, but it's just not available online. And then a ton of work has gone into producing Roy Thompson's Red Book and Chuck Watson worked on the IRA's summary program for a ton of radiobiology studies. So that work is there and it's started, and we just kind of need to finish it by putting it online and right. getting it available to the new researchers.
Right. And I still think that one of the big secrets is, are there things that we can do today with those tissues that we couldn't do when they were generated? And I think the people who were involved in those studies were very bright people, and they tried to do what they could. But there's things available today that weren't then. Anyway, we'll close it there. Appreciate your discussion. We'll let Bill take over.
Thank you, Tony. That was a really helpful discussion. I'd really like us to carry on with a lot of these themes tomorrow. So for the speakers, keep your talks succinct so we do have plenty of time for discussion. So for those of you that are having a dinner meeting here tonight, Sheila's made a reservation. It's under Beagle Conference. I think 11 people have signed up, and I think we've got a bigger table, so if anybody changes their mind and would like to join them, that's in the main restaurant. So the room we had lunch in is actually the bar. So instead of going straight ahead, turn right, and you'll see the main restaurant, and the reservation is made for 7 to 7.30. What I would suggest at this stage is we're going to resume at 8.30 tomorrow morning, but for those of you going down to Tony James's USTUR, you stay in this room, and you can organize the transportation for everything and that sort of thing, Tony. So let's close for tonight. For those of you going on the tour of USTUR, just stay around here, and Tony will take care of you. You can do whatever you like. Yep. Yeah. After,